love.
This video is a message from a little boy named Salman. He disappeared 5 years ago in Syria during the war to defeat ISIS. He still hasn't been found. My name is Poonam Taneja. I'm traveling to Syria to find out what happened to Salman and the thousands of children like him, lost in one of the most dangerous places on earth. From BBC Sounds and CBC Podcasts, Bloodlines. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast. The overdose crisis is one of the stories of our time. More than 42,000 Canadians have suffered opioid-related deaths since tracking began in 2016. Now, a class action lawsuit based in Quebec has been authorized against 16 pharmaceutical companies. The suit alleges that companies like Teva, Pfizer Canada, and Sanofi purposely misled consumers about the efficacy and the dangers of opioids. Margo Siminovich is part of the legal team representing members of the class action suit. Margo, good morning.
Good morning, Matt.
What exactly is being alleged in this class action lawsuit?
What's alleged is that opioids, which have been used medically for many, many years, were traditionally had very limited uses. They were used for palliative care, for example, end-of-life cancer treatment, or for very acute pain, post-surgery. And then in the mid-1990s, the pharmaceutical companies developed a new narrative where they took the same drugs and said that they were safe and efficacious for use with chronic pain. Mm. So everything from headaches to low back pain, rheumatoid arthritis, a variety of reasons. And of course, pain is very serious, but the warnings were insufficient in the context of chronic pain, where many of the companies said that the risk of addiction was very rare. And so obviously that's not true. And it's taken a long time for the companies to bolster the warnings that are given to the public and to healthcare professionals.
And so in that context, what are you suggesting the role of these companies was in, as I said, one of the stories of our time, this overdose crisis, this opioid crisis that has continued to cause such pain and suffering across Canada?
Well, what we're saying is it led to overprescribing of opioids. And the difficulty is once you're addicted, like when you're addicted to anything, if you're taken off the drug, you often can't cope. And many people then seek to get opioids in another way. Or even if over time they become tolerant to the opioids and they have to have greater and greater doses to alleviate their pain. And ultimately, it destroys their lives for many reasons. You talked about the fatalities, but many people who have not died or still have their lives destroyed. They're not able to work. They're irresponsible about finances, and it's really not their fault. They were prescribed opioids for a very legitimate reason, and they were really in pain, and they had no idea that they were going to develop opioid use disorder, which ultimately is addiction or dependence on these drugs.
Who are you bringing the case forward on behalf of? I mean, tell me the story of one of the people whose life has been impacted by these drugs.
Our class representative is a man, Monsieur Jean-François Bourassa. He lives in the Laurentians, and as a relatively young man in his 30s, he was running his own roofing business. And one day he was on a roof doing the repairs, and he slipped on ice and fell to the ground, very seriously injuring and breaking his leg and ankle. He was taken by ambulance to the hospital where he was put on opioids. He was discharged fairly quickly and then still had very serious pain. So he went to a pain clinic and he was put on opioids for the next 10 years. And as I say, they increased because he just became tolerant. And one of the things with opioids is sometimes you get what's called referred pain. So you're not even just getting pain in the original area where you might have had the injury. It starts having pain in other parts of your body. And essentially he feels that he lost his life with his young family, seeing his kids grow up. He was only able to work intermittently and eventually went on disability. And he just feels this whole process was so, so difficult. And in 2017, he realized that he just couldn't go on like this. So he sought treatment at a hospital for his addiction. And he was at that time diagnosed with opioid use disorder and gone through a very difficult process trying to withdraw from these drugs.
And this, the allegation is that despite what he went through and the broken leg and the broken ankle and the I'm sure extraordinary pain that he was in, that these companies, through their marketing, would have led him to become dependent on a drug that in other circumstances perhaps he would not have encountered.
So, exactly. So he was not given proper warnings at the beginning. He had no idea in these many years that he was put on opioids of the risks of addiction and dependence. And the difficulty is that marketing is in many, many forms. We interpret it in a very broad way, and so does the Canadian government in how they define marketing. It could be interviews with doctors in their offices where the companies say that the drugs are safe and that doctors who aren't prescribing them for their patients are doing a disservice for their patients. It can be in many ways supporting pain conferences and all sorts of kinds of marketing. It's they're not allowed to advertise anymore in the traditional sense of ads, you know, in a journal. But there are different ways to market. And these companies, like I say, they play down the risks of opioids. And traditionally, everybody knew how risky opioids were. So it wasn't like this was completely hidden in the world of science and medicine. Opioids are addictive. They've always been known to be addictive. And it was only in the mid-1990s when this sort of new story came out that they were safe for chronic pain.
What kind of drugs are involved in this class action? What are the specific drugs that you're talking about?
Well, there's many. We actually alleged probably over 200 drugs, which shows the scope of this class action, because there's quite a number of what we call active ingredients or active pharmaceutical ingredients. So they may contain fentanyl, which most people have heard of because of how dangerous fentanyl is, but the name of the drug might be something else. So, for example, Janssen, which many people know as Johnson & Johnson, marketed under the name Duragesic. And so people should really, really be careful to get their pharmaceutical records because they may not understand which drugs they're taking, because often you're given a drug and it may have a different name. It may have MTEC or some other drug that they don't even realize has codeine in it, has hydromorph contin. There are a variety of these pharmaceutical ingredients in these drugs, but they're all narcotics.
We're not talking specifically about, I mean, when people talk about the opioid crisis, the drug that often comes up in that discourse is OxyContin. You're not including that in this lawsuit.
No, because there was a national settlement for OxyContin, which in around 2012 was changed to OxyNeo, right, which was advertised as being more tamper resistant, so safer for use. And so there was a national settlement. So we have carved that out from our lawsuit. But people often get very confused because some of the names of the drugs, there is an active ingredient called oxycodone, and people may not realize that that's different than OxyContin. So as I say, people should be very careful to verify which opioids they have been prescribed.
We contacted a number of the companies that are named in this class action. Most of them don't want to comment because it's before the courts. Sanofi right. sent us a statement saying, "We respect the highest standards of ethics and integrity and conduct business in a responsible and sustainable way." They also deny any liability. What do you make of that response?
It's what you would expect. They'll go down to the end denying liability, but ultimately it's pretty clear. In fact, when you talk about OxyContin and Purdue is trying to get through bankruptcy proceedings in the U.S., and it's not that they've ever admitted liability. And yet, as you know, OxyContin has been known very well and the Purdue company for the wrongs that were done with respect to the marketing of the drug. So, you know, it's what's to be expected, but we have a very strong case. We're very passionate about it, very committed to helping the people that have been harmed by these drugs.
Just finally, I mean, how difficult is it to get those people who, as you say, have been harmed by these drugs to come forward and join an action like this? Because when it comes to issues of addiction, and we've spoken about this broadly, but specifically when it comes to the opioid crisis, there's still a stigma that's attached to that.
Absolutely. And people need to understand that they were put on these opioids for very legitimate reasons. Pain is terrible. Anybody who's experienced pain, either post-surgery or has back problems, is going to understand how terrible pain can be. And for people who have chronic pain, they are suffering. It's completely legitimate. So there is nothing wrong with the fact that they were put on opioids. The difficulty is that staying on them for a long time is extremely risky in terms of addiction. And we really hope that interviews like this one will allow people the freedom to come forward. It's very, very important that we hear their stories, that we have them know what's going on with the lawsuit, and that we get them into the class action and register. And they should go to the website where they can register, and they should be getting all of their information, like their pharmaceutical records, so that we have them preserved.
Margot, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Matt. Thank you.
Margot Simonovic is with Fishman, Flans, Milan, Paquin, LLP. It's one of the firms representing members of the class action lawsuit in Quebec against 16 pharmaceutical companies over their alleged role in the opioid epidemic. None of the allegations have yet been proven in court.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Dr. David Yearlink has been outspoken in his criticism of the way that opioids have been and continue to be prescribed. He's head of clinical pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Toronto. Dr. Yearlink, good morning to you.
Good morning, Matt.
This lawsuit covers anyone who's been diagnosed with opioid use disorder since 1996 in Quebec. Go back in time. From 1996, how were opioids prescribed?
Well, I might go back even a bit further than that. So I was a pharmacist in Nova Scotia in the early 90s, 1995, during medical school. And it wasn't that people were never put on opioids for pain, but they weren't prescribed in the same way that they came to be in the late 90s and through the 2000s. So what happened, and your earlier speaker sort of touched on this, is that in the late 90s, when OxyContin got a real toehold and began to be marketed aggressively, doctors began to prescribe it. And it was approved by Health Canada for chronic pain, for example, in a way that no other opioid had ever been prescribed. And so we began to prescribe it because we believed that we'd be helping patients. And as it turned out, I mean, we did sometimes help people with these drugs, but more often than not, and especially as the dose got ramped up over time, we ended up hurting people.
How did these drugs become kind of this go-to remedy for pain? I mean, Margot said that everybody knew that they were addictive.
So I don't think that's quite true. Yeah. So put yourself in a doctor's shoes. So most people go to medical school because they want to help people. That's the motivation for most physicians. And sometimes helping people takes the shape of treating an infection or fixing a broken bone. But more often than not, what doctors are doing to help people is relieving suffering. That's something we do every day. And sometimes that suffering is emotional, but sometimes it's physical. And I would say that the relief of suffering is probably the overarching goal of medical practice.
Somebody comes in pain, they want to be relieved of that pain.
Sure they do. And we want to help. And that's why we do what we do. And so to suddenly be told, not just by the drug companies that made these drugs, but by the experts who helped promote them, and by the regulators who got them let them onto the market, and by drug plans that paid for them, you know, to suddenly be told that we have this class of drugs that we've historically eschewed for pain and now we can use was a message we were happy to hear.
I mean, we've talked about and talked to Patrick Radden-Keefe, the author, about his extraordinary book on the Sacklers and Purdue Pharma, what he describes as a push by the company to through, you know, direct conversations, through sponsoring events and what have you, to get these drugs into the hands of doctors. Also talks about how short people's appointments are, and that can lead things to get to the drug, just to kind of get somebody through the system and then out the door. Mm-hmm. But there was also this paragraph that was in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980 that talked about addiction, right?
Oh, yes, this is a really important point. So one of the reasons why in the 80s and early 90s doctors didn't prescribe opioids for long periods of time was because we were worried — I wasn't practicing then, but doctors were worried about hurting people, and specifically worried about unmasking addiction in a patient who might have a propensity to it, genetic or otherwise. So one of the key messages that we got beginning in the late 90s was that we didn't need to fear that, because addiction was a rare consequence of opioid therapy. So the paragraph you're referring to that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is arguably the world's leading medical journal, and it's got a very declarative title. It says, addiction rare in patients treated with narcotics. So this one paragraph study, because it was buried in the back pages of a journal, it never really got read, but it got cited very heavily and promoted as evidence that doctors, you don't need to worry. This fear that you've had about inducing addiction in a patient just because of a well-intentioned pain treatment is one you don't need to worry about. And as it turns out, that information was also just not — the paragraph told us exactly nothing about the risk of long-term addiction with opioid therapy.
Knowing what we know now, and I mean, I mentioned the number of deaths, opioid-related deaths in this country, 42,000 plus, the number continues to climb. How is it different? What is different now when it comes to how these drugs are prescribed in Canada?
Well, I think you've touched on an important point. We talk about the opioid crisis. It's not really one thing. I mean, the most pressing issue today is the toxic drug crisis that you alluded to in your opening. People who are at risk of dying today because of a drug supply that's very unpredictable. And so this — we're not talking here — those people need a specific set of interventions, and they need it urgently. But on the treatment of pain front, I think we still use opioids. I prescribe them. I'm an opioid hawk now. I prescribe them all the time, though. I just do it differently than I did, say, 20 years ago.
How so?
I start them less readily. I still use them, but I am mindful of the fact that they've got side effects that can be very, very challenging for even a vigilant doctor to identify. So I start them more cautiously. I'm very, very careful about escalating the doses. That's something that — this is another important point. One of the other messages we got about opioids was that with ongoing use, sometimes the analgesia they afford lessens. And so what we were taught is just to go up on the dose, gradually increase the dose to try and overcome that loss of effectiveness. And that's something we do with almost no other class of drugs. And it should come as no surprise that as we progressively escalate doses of opioids in an effort to chase pain, all of the other side effects that can happen with opioids can really accrue. And so it's very easy to find yourself in a position where after 6 months or a year or 5 years of opioid therapy, patients are often in a position where the doses have gone up over time and where they're actually being harmed in ways that are hard to appreciate. That's often an unwelcome claim for people who are on these drugs, but it's just true.
There was a report that was done in 2021. It showed 1 in 8 people in Canada received at least one prescription for opioids from a community pharmacy. That's about 4.6 million Canadians. That seems like a high number to me.
Yeah, I think if you were to do that same study 15 years earlier, it'd probably be even higher. I don't want to give the sense that these drugs shouldn't be used. They are very valuable drugs in the right hands, but I still think that we overprescribe them to a certain extent. And I see this. Most people have had wisdom teeth taken out, and it's very common still to get a prescription for Tylenol 3 or Percocet after you've had that done, even though we know that that's no better. In fact, probably inferior to anti-inflammatories and Tylenol for that kind of pain. It's reflective of a culture that a culture of medical practice that still sees opioids as our best, strongest pain relievers. And it's very clear that they are not that.
I mean, ultimately, and this goes back to what you said earlier, people are coming in to the doctor's office, coming out of surgery, coming out of having their wisdom teeth or their hip replaced or what have you, and they're looking for pain relief. Are there other alternatives to opioids, new ways of treating pain perhaps, that are being explored now that would avoid those concerns?
Well, there are there are other drugs we can use. I mean, most doctors have a fairly straightforward approach. We start with, you know, Tylenol and anti-inflammatories if they're safe to use. And when those don't work, we'll often quickly go to opioids, weak ones and then stronger ones. But there are lots of other drugs that we can try. Sometimes antidepressants, sometimes drugs for nerve pain, sometimes drugs in hospitals where I work, and we've got lots of other options because we can use intravenous routes of therapy. You know, cannabinoids sometimes. So there are other drugs that we can try. But the reality is that when you start a patient on a pain medicine, like, you don't really know in advance and whether you're going to really help them or not. And you don't really know in advance whether you're going to cause side effects or not. So it really is, in a real sense, you're conducting an experiment in real time on the patient. And we have different drugs we can try, but you don't know until you've tried them what's going to work.
And if perhaps you're using those less potent, if I can put it that way, treatments, if somebody has chronic pain, they could come back to you and say, I'm sorry, this doesn't work. And they could be quite upset by that.
Oh, yeah, sure. It happens all the time. But in general, I think most docs can find some combination of medications that, you know, can help patients feel better. I think one of the things that we also we do less now than we did, say, 15 years ago, is try and get that pain score down to zero. I mean, I think if we've got someone whose pain is an 8 out of 10 or a 9 out of 10, and we can get it to a 4 or a 3, I mean, I think we need to grant that that's a real win. And nobody wants to be in pain, but the idea that we should try and bring that 4 or a 3 down to a 1 or a 0 has led a lot of patients to be harmed by well-intentioned therapies. So I think sometimes, I hate to say it, but sometimes we need to accept the fact that pain is part of life, and getting it somewhat better is often the best we can do.
In the face of that, just finally, when is it appropriate to prescribe opioids? We've talked a lot, and we talk about stigma around addiction. These drugs have a stigma as well because of everything that we've been speaking about. When is it appropriate to prescribe them?
You'll get different answers depending on who you ask. Mm. And I think let's keep in mind that there are three groups of people out there. There are people who aren't on opioids right now. There are people who've been on them for years and aren't addicted. And there are people with opioid use disorder. And the answer to that question really depends on which patient population we're talking about. But let's take the people who aren't on opioids. I think that we can still use these drugs, but using them sparingly, not giving a 14-day supply when 3 or 4 days is likely to help, not relentlessly increasing the doses, trying to sort of chase a pain that's, you know, that's always going to be there.
Also talking to the patients about how to taper off of them, right?
That's one of the most difficult discussions I as a doctor have with patients, is people who've been on these drugs for often a decade or more, who've escalated to high doses over that time, and trying to say to them, listen, you know, I can pull up a chair at the bedside in the hospital and over the span of 45 minutes or an hour, try to convince them that, you know, if we can just taper your dose very, very gradually over time, often you'll feel better. But it's not something that people typically want to hear. And that's a reflection of the fact, and this is an unfortunate fact about opioids, is they change the structure and the function of our brains in a way that that once you've been on them for a while, they're very hard to come off of, and people often don't want to.
David, good to talk to you as always. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Dr. David Yearlink is the head of clinical pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Toronto.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.